Welcome to the Ripple Revolution Podcast. In this podcast, we take a new look at how we think about making a difference, with an approach that integrates the work we do in our lives and the difference we make in the world. Today, I'm talking to Bill Strickland. It's hard to come up with a short description of what Bill does. He's the CEO of Manchester Bidwell Corporation, an organization with a life-changing arts program for inner-city youth and a possibility-creating trade school. He's the author of one of my favorite books, Make the Impossible Possible. He's the catalyst behind the Grammy Award-winning MCG Jazz record label. He was appointed by President Obama to the White House Council for Community Solutions, and by President Bush to the board of the National Endowment for the Arts. Oh, and he's the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. So thank you, Bill, for joining us here on the Ripple Revolution podcast. I am really excited to be talking to you. I've been reading your book as in preparation for this. I read it when it first came out, and I have to say, it's kind of one of those things where you suddenly, the book you're reading is saying the right things at the right time, and it kind of has been feeling like, wow, he wrote this for me. And so it's been really exciting to read that again, and it had a really strong impact for me. So thank you very much for being here.
Yes.
So now looking at your life, you've just had this amazing impact with your life, and I find what you've accomplished and the difference that you've been able to make in your life just by itself inspiration enough. But then when I look at where you came from and the expectations one might normally have of somebody in that circumstance, my head kind of wants to explode. Could you share a little bit about how your life started off and how you found the path that you're on now?
Well, basically, I grew up in a pretty tough inner city neighborhood in Pittsburgh, basically a neighborhood where I still live. And at that time, it was during the turbulence of the 60s and 70s. There were a lot of racial incidents, a lot of race riots. Dr. King had been assassinated and so on. And it was pretty tough going in the community. A lot of drugs, a lot of crime, a lot of personal violence and so forth. So it was a real classic sort of inner city ghetto kind of situation. And I was lucky enough to have a wonderful mother who really loved me and my brother and really worked hard to try to create a nurturing environment for her kids in the midst of these very, very difficult circumstances. I believe it was her efforts to do that that really set the stage for my meeting Frank Ross, who turned out to be the art teacher at our public school, a place called Oliver High School. So when I enrolled at Oliver in the 10th grade, I actually met Mr. Ross almost by accident, and he was a ceramic artist. I watched him work on the wheel. I really fell in love with the wheel and the idea clay. So for all practical purposes, I really apprenticed to Frank for the remainder of my high school years, got very good at clay, but Frank says, you're really too smart to die. You need to go to college. So he encouraged me to go to the University of Pittsburgh, where I enrolled as an undergrad with the intent of becoming a history teacher and teaching the school system. But while I was at Pitt, there was tough times in the streets. I wanted to reach out and help. So I kind of went back to revisit my roots in clay. And the long and short of the story is, I found that during the riots, a program called Manchester Craftsman's Guild around ceramics and photography, and started recruiting kids from the public school system and recruiting kids from the street to save their lives, with art being the intervention strategy. And that's how this whole story got launched.
Now, one of the things that really, really inspires me, everywhere I turn, I've got this inspiration going on. So it's something that I find myself saying a lot as I'm talking about your story. One of the things that inspires me there is not just the fact that you had this
trajectory that changed into this other trajectory, and how cool is that? But really the impact that Mr. Ross had on your life. And then as a result of that, the impact that what you've been doing has had on all of these other lives. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that?
Yeah, because in effect, it was really a mentorship role that Frank played in my life. He didn't think of it that way. I certainly didn't think of it that way. But that, in fact, is what it was, where not only did he teach me about clay, he invited me to explore other areas of my development. For example, on one of the class field trips, we went to see Falling Water, Frank Lloyd Wright's famous house in just outside of Pittsburgh. Mr. Ross used to bring in jazz albums. He thought that jazz might be something I'd be very interested in. It turned out he was right. I got involved with photography, started taking pictures of various forms of architecture and delivering papers, thoughts, in class on these various styles of architecture. I got off into reading haiku poetry. He encouraged me to speak about that in class. So through his apprenticeship mentoring, I got exposed to a lot more than clay. I got exposed to learning, environment, opportunity, multidiscipline, and that was the jumping off point that really began to shape my life and the future direction for myself. And it's a system and a methodology that we've turned into a program called Manchester Craftsman's Guild here in Pittsburgh, but it's really based on that kind of apprenticeship experience I had with Frank in the 60s when I was in high school.
Excellent. And part of what happened there was not just the opening the eyes to these different kinds of things and starting to engage. It was also shifting how you saw your own potential and where your life could go and the opportunities, et cetera, rather than just the inertia of the path that everybody around you seemed to be on.
Yeah, the message that Frank really conveyed was, you're an asset, not a liability. I'm going to treat you that way. That just because my academic performance had not been stellar, in Frank's view, had nothing really to do with the ability to learn. It had everything to do with the environment, encouragement, values, and so forth. And I think that that's very true. People learn in different ways. They also learn at different times. And by Frank starting off with the assumption that I had the ability to do extraordinary things, guess what? I did extraordinary things over time. So that behavior and values, attitude, all are key components of learning. And I've made that into a program, an institutional strategy for working with kids who are really having very similar issues that I was confronted with when I came along.
Excellent. So what just from a perspective of the impact that your organization has and what impact that it has on these kids' lives, et cetera, could you talk a little bit about what the outcome of that has been?
Well, over the years, we've averaged high school graduation rates in the 90 percentile with kids who are generally dropping out of the school system at the rate of 50%. So we've taken what many call at-risk kids, and we put them in this arts ed program after school for up to 4 years, and 90% plus of those kids graduate from high school. And in many years, we've had at least 90% of those kids go on to some form of college or higher education. So we've had a direct, measurable outcome, an impact, on kids who have been marginalized. We know that for sure. Number two, five of my faculty here at the center are kids who actually went through the program as high school kids, who went off to college and came back to teach at the center that basically saved their life.
Wow.
We also have three PhDs that I know of personally, and we have many people now in professions that would have been unthinkable to them had they not had the experience of the Manchester Craftsman's Guild program here in Pittsburgh. So it's been overwhelmingly successful. And now that we're replicating the idea around the country, we're beginning to get similar evidence in communities where centers now exist.
That's great. That's great. In your book, there's a part that I loved where you talk about jazz as a metaphor for life, and which is something that started off with something that Dizzy Gillespie said to you. Could you talk a little bit more about that jazz as a metaphor?
Well, when Dizzy Gillespie came here, I had the presence of mind. This is when the building just opened in 86, and he was one of the first concerts. And it was a great honor to obviously meet him, and I gave him a tour of the place. And Dizzy turned to me and he said, you're too young to appreciate what you built here, but I'm not. And you ought to build a center like this in every city in this country before you start building them around the world. I'm going to help you. So he allowed us to record his concert. He gave us the rights to the music. And then he started talking to guys like Herbie Hancock and Wynton Marsalis and Joe Williams and many, Nancy Wilson, Betty Carter, Shirley Horn. So these extraordinary musicians, jazz musicians, in part because of Dizzy's presence here, started coming to do jazz concerts at our center, and it's turned out to be one of the most important jazz conversations in the world. We won 5 Grammys for our recordings, so we have our own record label. So it's really turned out to be quite a story. So it was all about exposure. It was all about guys like Dizzy coming here and saying, this is huge. This is much bigger than you even realize. So I've had some extraordinary people encourage me to continue to do this work and to build on it.
And he had said something about Manchester Bidwell being your song, and it started. You started talking about how jazz then really is a metaphor for living life and what it is that you do.
Yeah, he basically said, boy, you're a heck of a jazz musician. And I said, I'm not a jazz musician. I don't play an instrument. He said, oh, yes, you do. The center is your song. And any guy that's smart enough to put culinary arts, photography, med tech, chemistry, ceramics, and jazz together in a building is a jazz musician. And I've never forgotten that statement or that encouragement.
Yeah. So what does, if you're looking at jazz kind of as that metaphor, what does that mean for you?
Well, jazz, as a rule, generally is improvisational in nature.
Mm-hmm.
There's an underlying structure to the music, of course, but it is improvisational. And most of the work that we do here at the center is improvisational in the sense that we are very open to new ideas and innovation and change. We want to build on experiences, not just rely on experiences. And we want to constantly be changing the song, if you will, to improve on it, to make it more crisp, more broad, more ecumenical, et cetera. And that's what really jazz musicians are all about. I happen to know because I've listened to them at close range for 25 years. And you see guys that would come to Pittsburgh from 4 different parts of the world to do a concert in our center, and they go out on stage and rehearse for maybe an hour and play for the next 2 days as if they've been together for 30 years. And not one thing is written down on a piece of paper. That's pretty extraordinary.
Right.
And that level of intelligence and learning is what we are trying to apply at our center here every day in terms of what we do.
Right. So along the same lines of that, one of the things that you had written, you said, Dizzy said Manchester Bidwell was my song. We all have that kind of song in our hearts, a song that tells us who we are and what we genuinely want from life. And so I was looking at that, and I had a little bit of a different spin. Rather than Manchester Bidwell specifically being your song, it seems like it's kind of an instrument for the expression of your song.
Okay.
And so if you look at it that way, what's your song? What is the song in your heart? What is it you're here to do? What is it you're here to express?
To change the conversation about poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in the U.S., but hopefully around the world. That I view poor people as assets in disguise. And it's the way that you treat people and the environment that you treat them in that often derives in outcomes and results. And so my song is really to try to use the arts and vocational education in the way that we practice it in Pittsburgh to change the conversation about poverty in any country and in any community willing to talk to us. I'm ready and willing to go and have that conversation. And so we have eight centers now as of September open and operating beyond Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's 9. And we've got another 50 cities talking to us around the world of building centers. And so we're now beginning to build momentum to have a much broader song and a much deeper song that's playing in many locations across many countries. And so what I'm really after is to change the conversation about poverty in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And devote resources, energy, intelligence to changing this paradigm. And I want to do it in my lifetime so that the group coming behind me will be able to build on that experience.
Right. Nice. I think that just in my own experience working with people for the last dozen years, I've worked with people helping them figure out what lights me up, what difference do I feel called to make, and then how do I weave that into my career and really into my life, that people have that song sitting in there, inside unsung generally, but it's not... they don't recognize that they have it. They don't have easy access to it. Do you have any ideas as to what you have found helps open the door to that song for people? Find their own song?
Changing your experience, getting outside of your experience, going and experiencing others, other people, other cultures, other music, other food, other literature, that there are many things that are available even to the most economically disadvantaged. If you can get out of your immediate space and to try to capitalize and take advantage of things that can give you a deeper insight into what a real quality life looks like. I'm a big believer in reading. I'm a big believer in observation. And I think that that is the kind of thing that is more universally applied. We could have a much more ambitious conversation about getting at poverty and getting at people who have lost hope.
Right.
If we can reestablish hope, then we can reestablish possibility.
Right. And so a lot of it is really how do you get beyond the inertia created by the blinders that we all wear?
Correct. And my life story, as it turns out, is an example of going past the blinders.
Yep.
Starting off in the inner city, no ability in the arts, no direction, no vision. And now I'm having conversations with guys like you about what's turned out to be a pretty interesting life over the last 40 years.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think doesn't get enough attention out there in the motivational speaking and kind of the self-help guru set, et cetera, is the idea that, you know what, fear, uncertainty, doubt, all of these things, they're going to come up. They're going to be a part of the process. They're going to be a part of the journey. That's just really a part of life. So I'm always fascinated to throw the question out there to people. When you bump into these kinds of things, into the fear, into the uncertainty, the doubt, these things that kind of can narrow your view and limit you, what do you find What do you find effective in moving through that, grappling with those, dealing with those kinds of things?
In terms of doubt?
Whether it's fear. Hey, you've done so much that most people would look at and say, it's too scary to do that, or I don't want to fail at doing that. You know, maybe it's fear of failure, maybe it's whatever, maybe it's uncertainty. I don't know what I'm doing. Doubt, is this really a good idea? So these things that people run into.
Right. Well,
what helps you when that happens?
Well, you have to break the habit of being negative about yourself, and it's a habit. It's a psychology that gets deeply embedded by virtue of certain kinds of experiences, poverty, racism, sexism, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that you can begin to break that down as a habit pattern is to create a different habit pattern so that you begin to think positively, eat positively, be around positive people, try positive things, and initially you start very slowly. In my case, it was learning to do clay on a potter's wheel. And at first, you know, I'm pretty inept at this, but after a week or two, you start to get your balance. A month or two goes by, and you start to pull up little 2-inch pots that look pretty good, and then it's 4-inch pots, and then it's 10-inch pots, and then, you know, a year or two later, you know, you're making great big pots that are very competent and very capable. So I began to build confidence in my ability to do something by doing something, by trying something and staying with it to the point where my fear began to subside and confidence took its place. But it did not start as a magic pill. Nobody gave me a pill to swallow. Nobody waved a magic wand over my head or sprinkled fairy dust. This was left foot in front of right, sustained effort over a long period of time. And that experience becomes cumulative, because if you can accomplish it in one sector of your life, the learning that will take place can affect all sectors of your life in time. So that when I decided I was going to become an airline pilot, having never really flown airplanes before, I had the background of knowing that I had built a small center in Pittsburgh, not the one we're in now, but we were on our way, that I was competent, I had graduated from college, that I was a smart guy, I knew how to read, and that I could probably end up in time flying airplanes. So I started off flying very small airplanes, the equivalent of starting off at the potter's wheel with a small piece of clay. And over the time, over the 6, 8, 10 years of time, I acquired experience, got all my professional ratings, and ended up flying Boeing 727s for Braniff Airlines from a guy who had no background in aviation, no military experience. And at the time, I was about 23, 24 years old, which for aviation is pretty late, actually. So I'm trying to make the point that one experience successfully impacts another. But if you don't have any successful experiences, you're going to end up walking in a circle. And you can do that for the rest of your life if you're not careful.
Right. And so there's the interesting direct line from that first wobbly pot to being a pilot, to doing all of these amazing things that you have been able to set in motion.
They're all connected with a line. There's a line that runs through all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm proposing in the work that we do is to create the environment where children and adults really start their own conversation. They start their own line of evolution. In ceramics or photography, in culinary arts, in medical technology, they begin to have their own different conversation, building confidence, building ability, and starting to see themselves as assets and not liabilities. And we now have overwhelming evidence that this process works. We've got 20 generations of students that have gone through. We've got 5 centers open and thriving around the United States. They're all getting the same kind of incredible outcomes as we're getting in Pittsburgh. So we know we're on to something very important.
Absolutely. I love that. So you were talking about the conversation, and that actually is a great lead-in to the next question that I have. One of the things that you have talked about is this idea of telling your story and getting really adept at telling your story and being really clear what your story is so that other people have the potential to find how that engages with their story. Can you talk about the impact this idea of getting really clear on what your story is has had on your own journey and then on the difference you see it make for people in general?
Well, people are reading the book, and many people are attracted to the book because it's approachable. It's written in very simple language, deliberately. The stories are real world in real time. It does not require a lot of cerebral preparation to read the book. And people respond to the book because it sounds and feels like many of the things that they've experienced in their own lives. So that there's a methodology of communication created in the book. Vince Rouse, who was the guy that actually wrote the book with me, was able to capture what many people have called my voice. He captured in words what my voice is in sound. And that's why I believe that the book has been so powerful. It's now sold over 70,000 copies. I ended up at the United States Military Academy at West Point because one of the commandants had gotten the book and read it and invited me up to speak to the cadets, which turned out to be quite a day. So I've had people, an ex-convict, who sent me a letter saying, I got out of the jail cell system because your book, for whatever reason, ended up in the prison library. And I happened to stumble onto this book. And I used that book as my guide to get my life rebuilt, which resulted in my getting out of the penitentiary. And I'm now employed, and I have a life in front of me. Thank you for writing the book. I've never met this man. The only way I've communicated with him is on the telephone and through email. So from the West Point to an ex-convict and a lot of people in between, this vehicle is creating some pretty interesting conversations, not just in the U.S. There are now conversations beginning to happen around the world.
Mm. That's superb. One of the things that you say in the book is that everybody has a story, and we're telling that story all the time, and we can't not have our story. And that one of the things that really is magical about getting clear on that is that when we can tell our story it in a really clear way, and the way that you described it is that underneath all of them lies a simpler, deeper story with a more fundamental message. This is what I stand for. This is who I am. It starts to open up doors for other people to connect. How has that been the case for you?
Well, what I've been able to become as a spokesperson, hopefully for common sense, which is in very short supply in the world right now. and you know, my life, as we've talked about it, is kind of literally an open book. And I'm very proud of the fact that I continue to do the work that I was inspired to do by Frank Ross and those folks in high school. So people can relate to me. The kids can see me here at the school. I drive a regular old car. I take the garbage out on Thursdays just like everybody else. And I try to live a life that makes some sense. And that people would say, you know, that guy's doing a good job. He's the kind of guy I'd like to be like when I grow up. So I've accepted the responsibility, you know, of being a leader, but also accepting the responsibility of a little humility that kind of goes with the profession that I've assumed to be a part of. I think both are very important. So that I'm not the story, the work is the story. That's
right.
The important story.
Right, right. One of the things that is so clear is that it's not just you that has been behind this, that it's the support of others has been a huge part what has happened for you. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that and the importance of reaching out and recognizing opportunities for that support?
Well, I've had many people step up and continue to step up to help me build a strategy for changing the lives of poor people. And you cannot do it by yourself. You've got to have help from the community. And people from all backgrounds and all races and all economic strata and all political backgrounds are welcome to be a part of the conversation. So that really at the end of the day becomes a community conversation, not just a Bill Strickland conversation. And I think that everybody's got a role to play. You know, I've often said I'm a potter, so I make kitchenware. And I'm quite capable of making another plate for another guest at the table. And I think that approach and that attitude is exactly what the world needs to see a lot more of. That we're all capable of sitting down together and sharing from, you know, the common food and a common belief system and a common recognition that we all need each other. I think that's very important, and I will continue to say that message as long as people are willing to listen.
I love that. That's hugely important. Last question for you. With this idea of making the impossible possible, if you were to distill it into just the biggest piece of advice that you have for people when they're looking at making the impossible possible in their own lives, what would that be?
The message would be, you can change the circumstances of your birth. You can change the circumstances of your environment. Not easily, but it is possible. And that the first thing you need to begin to do is to educate yourself by learning more about others who have made that journey or who are making that journey. And that way you can learn from those experiences. It will give you the encouragement and hopefully the stimulation to at least try. I guarantee you, if you don't try, you'll never get there. But there are enough stories out here, mine and a few others, that can really sort of help you in your journey. And so you can take the time to educate yourself. And also, in my case, we have an open invitation for anybody interested in this topic or this subject to come visit our center. But we now have 6 centers open around the U.S. Go visit them. That's something you can do. So I am really very much about trying to make a difference in your life where you're located. But you have to begin to think in terms of 24/7, 365, not 9-to-3.
Right. So really showing up. Excellent. I really appreciate your time and really enjoyed the conversation and really enjoyed your insights. Where can people find out more about what you're up to, more about the book, et cetera? Is there a website you can share?
Yeah, well, basically the easiest thing to do is just to Google my name, and it will take you to the website.
Okay.
Or you can get there through www.mcgjazz.com. You can get there through www.mbc.com, ManchesterBidwellCorp.com. Or if all else fails, just Google my name, because it will tie you into all the websites. The book's on there. You can buy it on Amazon. It's pretty cheap. So there are many vehicles available to continue to stay in touch with this story as it evolves.
Excellent. Okay, well, I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your insights, and I definitely appreciate your inspiration.
Thank you.